Welcome everyone to Legends of Jorvik, episode 4 in my bonus mini-series where I get to invite and talk to the many creatives and talented and skilled people who make the Jorvik Viking Festival the amazing event that it is every year. And this week's episode, I'm delighted to welcome Jason Buck, a professional storyteller. Welcome, Jason.
Hello, thank you very much. Thank you very much for asking me on.
You're welcome. I really enjoyed your event and I cannot wait to start quizzing you on the stories you told because there were some wonderful ones. I wish I could tell all my friends about it, but I can never do it justice like you did. So I guess we should touch base then on, because many people not know who or what a professional storyteller is or how would someone would get into that profession. Would you mind telling us more?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's an interesting thing because you're absolutely right. Storytelling is one of those things that we all do. We all do every day. We all tell stories about what we did yesterday or the film we saw or what's happening or some experience we have. We just do it quite naturally as people, as humans. But in Western Europe and Britain, and certainly in England, in the United Kingdom, storytelling or performance storytelling really is something that people aren't used to. It's something that's died away, less so in Wales and Ireland and Scotland, where people know about storytelling a bit more. But the thing I'm always terrified that I think people always assume is that I'm someone sat in the corner of the children's library in a colorful coat on a tiny stool reading the Gruffalo upside down to a group of small people. Performance storytelling is what we've done for our entire history since we could speak and understand our languages. In terms of the experience, it's a bit like going to a stand-up comedy gig. You have a storyteller who is standing there live, sometimes mic'd up, sometimes not, usually never, but almost never with a handheld mic because it gets in the way of being able to point and gesticulate. But you're telling stories to the audience. You're talking to the audience as just like a stand-up comic would. But those stories, they could be modern, recent stories, or they could be ancient myths and legends, especially things, and we're going to talk today about, Norse mythology or Viking legends. And so it's relaying those and creating a narrative that people can sit back and really lose themselves, immerse themselves in the pictures that the storyteller conjures in their minds as they listen to the story unfolding. And the storyteller is all the characters and describes everything that's going on. And it really is for all ages, from very small till they reach a point in the life where you can hear no more and then drift off to the next world.
Thank you. That's a really wonderful explanation. And it certainly kind of reminded me, because you performed to children as well during the Jorvik Viking Festival, didn't you?
Well, I did. I did a bit of stuff out in the street dressed in proper Viking clobber. And I don't mean horned helmet and a double-headed axe, in the sort of tunic and whatnots and things. And the street performance stuff, people naturally see a storyteller and parents often then wheel children over. At the beginning, I think, of my career as a full-time storyteller, I was very much against I didn't want to be thought of as a children's entertainer. And so I very much sort of steered away from that. But since then, apart from it being very useful to pay the bills, telling stories to children are great. It's great because they're quite happy just to sit down and go, go on then, and just lose themselves. Whereas adults are sort of a bit more, whilst they're terribly polite and will sit and listen, quietly, adults often are a little bit sort of more reserved and wondering, oh God, is he going to get me to do something? Am I going to be called out? Or I'm not quite sure what's happening here. Whereas the children just accept it and just kind of and get on with it. But it's two related but sort of different different styles of telling stories, I think.
Mm. So how did you, as a storyteller, first encounter, experience, or work with Norse mythology or Viking history as a story medium and matter?
I think when I started telling stories as a storyteller, then somebody gave me, one of my audience gave me a present. It's a guy who'd come along to a couple of my shows, and he turned up one day and he said, "Thank you very much, Jason. I'm really enjoying your storytelling. Would you mind if I gave you a present?" I said, "Of course not. Thank you very much." And he gave me a book. It was the Penguin Book of Norse Mythology. It was a nice collection, and inside was a very nice sort of note written about how he had stumbled across my storytelling shows and how, whilst he was going through some stuff in his own life, how actually he found that immersion in the stories awoke a sort of a something that he said he hadn't felt since he was a child, and allowed himself to become immersed within a story. And so he gave me this as a present. And for a while, I just thought, well, that's very nice. I'll just put that on the shelf. And then one day I was thinking, I should really... I should do a new show soon, shouldn't I? And I thought I should start reading that book. And I hadn't really gone into Norse mythology much at the time. And so when I started reading that book, and then of course reading other books and other references and watching videos and looking at various websites and articles and things, it suddenly opened up a world to me that I think I'd always assumed was a little bit probably tainted by Hollywood, I imagine. It was all a bit too much swords and sorcery, as opposed to the depth of story and mythology and religion and history that's there. And then I think it helps that, you know, I'm 6'4" and I've got a big, you know, curly moustache and beard. I'm all terribly hairy, and I can pronounce the Norse names. So I'm told by some of the people who either speak Old Norse or various modern versions of, you know, the Scandinavian languages, have said, wow, I can actually understand the words you were saying, you know, when you're this name or that name. And it's like, oh, wow, it works. Great. And so I think a combination of those things came together. And I really like the mythologies. I like the Norse gods. They were like the Greek gods. They are imperfect, and they are flawed, like ourselves. And it's not just a set of tales and rules of dogma about an unimpeachable deity who never arrives. These are kind of tales about us and tales about gods and monsters, and where that needle is on the is it a god, is it a person, and what's the experience kind of moves from side to side. And I think that's what really attracted me, that movement between our mortal experience and tales of gods and monsters, and there's sort of no barrier between the two of them.
That is brilliant, and I absolutely chime well with that message about them being flawed and imperfect.
Yeah,
I remember back in my early days, back when I was just discovering how podcasting worked, I was able to be a guest on a podcast episode of the Jorvik Viking Thing podcast back when it was active and round, with Joanne Harris and Jessica Simon and Professor Caroline Larrington, who is a big Oxford expert in this area. Goodness. And I was telling them what I think people get drawn to is their imperfectness. They're basically humans who just happen to have really magical toys. Like, they've got magical apples that help them live longer. Thor's got his gauntlets and his hammer and his belt, and Odin's got all his trinkets and Freya hers. And they squabble, they fight, they have jealousies. I mean, Loki, of course, is on the trickster to the underdog and the anti-hero in the way that modern perception has reinterpreted and revived and adapted. And because we don't have a lot of core details about them, because these sagas are all bits and pieces and they were written down centuries after Christianization, and don't get me started on what stories might have been lost, because there were probably hundreds. These gaps have actually enabled them to keep going because they're malleable, because we can then adapt them to reflect whatever society and we as people are feeling at the time, which I quite like about them.
And to add to that, I think that's what keeps the stories alive. That's a really good point, because I think once you have, religions that have holy books that say this is the truth for our religion, then you can't stray away from that. So all you're really doing is retelling. There's no idea, there's not much scope for interpretation or reflection about what the characters in the story might be doing or thinking and how that relates to us. It's all kind of rather clearly set out. And of course, you understand why people do that, so they can set down the rules and say, these are the definitive rules. But at the same time, I think you're absolutely right. It's interesting, I think, what modern culture has done to the Norse myths. When you look at things like the Marvel franchise, a friend of mine's a head teacher at a school, and they had an open day, and they studied the Norse gods, as I think it's on the general syllabus, or Norse mythology anyway. And she overheard some child saying to their parents as they were going through, saw there was a picture of Thor, and he went, look, they study Marvel here? Amazing, we must come here. It's very sweet at the same time, kind of, oh dear. And when I tell stories about Thor and his hammer to younger audiences, I have to say, you know, it's not like in the films. Anyone can touch Thor's hammer. Anyone can use it. It's just that it's Thor's hammer. And Loki, he doesn't go, ooh, and he's not super, yes, he's a super powerful staff. You know, he's just a trickster because he fixes things as well as breaking things. And I have to sort of put them right on that. But again, with children, they're kind of like, okay. All right, if you say so, carry on. So they'll take that, and that elasticity is there.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I guess it all reflects back to the fact that these were stories. They've always been stories. Of course, the Vikings weren't illiterate people. They could carve runes, but that came along a lot later. They only ever used runes usually on runestones memorial to someone who'd gone off raiding or went sailing and just never came back. They didn't need to record these things because they were told, and people like you were around at that time. They had skalds, like professional storytellers. So you're carrying on a verified heritage, Jason. And I like to think, certainly I nodded towards it in my own little independent research on representation and indeed interpretation of Valkyries in fantasy fiction, as my humble debut article is going through peer review, and I'm hoping they'll agree with any of my nonsense and not tell me it's all nonsense. That even the skalds probably back then probably omitted, adapted or twisted things, because certain people will have heard things in different regions. I mean, we've got the Saga of the Volsungs, and then we've got the Ring of the Nibelungs, and they're both use the same set of characters, but in a different set of circumstances, slightly, and yet they're like written centuries apart. It's incredible how stories are just last, don't they?
So I have this bracelet here, which on it has just so you can see there, there's runes on it, and it is a quote from the Skald. His name's gone out of my head. And what it says on it, the translation is, what is a skilled smith of verse? What is a skald but that? Hugsmith Braga, what is skald name of that in Old Norse, if you want it? And it doesn't say, what is a skald but a knowledgeable repeater of verse, a skilled smith of verse? Bragi, which is the name of the... the skald, I think, the skald god, skald deified, skald, when you put him. But that's quote attributed to him, and it is talking about a skilled smith of verse, so someone who creates things, not someone who just can remember and reproduce. It's not just an actor who's learned all the works of Shakespeare and is able to quote, you know, anything at any point. There's that ability, but also the ability to craft and make and create and change. Indeed, you use the word malleable. So let's use that malleable Latin, malleus, being a smith and making and changing and shaping. Not fixed.
Oh, well, I'm glad you agree with me, and hopefully the peer reviewers of my little article will agree with what nonsense I've typed up. So I guess in terms of, as you pointed out, kind of like shaping and creating and not necessarily just repeating stories, obviously when I attended your wonderful event at Jorvik this year, we heard an amazing...
as well, by the way, thank you. Not just my event, but my wonderful event, thank you.
It is a wonderful event. I really, really enjoyed it. And I love how you were there to actually greet everyone in the room as well. I was like, oh, it's the guy who greeted me earlier. You told a wonderful tale about, I think it was around 12th century Iceland, of a young man getting involved in necromancy, in a very long and winding tale. And I loved how you explained about it. It's all like one step away from evil. No one's outright evil. It's all that gradual step. And I really liked that as an introduction to the theme of the story. So is that one that you've sourced or read about and then revived? Or is it one of your own creation using influences from that time?
So there's now three stories in my head, in my collection, whatever, which I would class as my sort of dark Norse stories, and they're all original stories by me, but they're all based around or using either history or folklore elements or folklore ideas and tropes. So in that, the Narbrook, the necro pants, as they're translated to usually into American English, the necro trousers. And if people listening, if you don't know what they are, look it up. But I warn you now about what you'll find out. And especially, they have a pair of them in the Museum of Witchcraft in Iceland, a reproduction pair of them, let's say. yes, because they're not real. But that was all. Yeah, I came across this idea of these dead men's legs, the skins that people peel off one man's legs and peel onto their own, and then bringing wealth. But of course, that's evil and wicked and evil. And it was only as I was starting to write the story and look into it and try and find out more about the Narbrook that I was reading information about how it was suggested that there was a particular guy in Iceland who was doing very well, and his farm did very well, and he became very wealthy. And as often, you know, when in communities, when somebody's doing very well, somebody else gets jealous about it. And so that, you know, kind of rumors and whatnots were created about, oh, it must be black magic. It can't possibly just be because of hard work and talent and ability and everything else, you know, must be black magic. And so saying that it was only black magic that made it possible for this guy to be prosperous. Which is the explanation for the real Narbrook necropants. But it was that idea of journey. And there was a number of things I happened to come across. The fact that the main character plays the langspiel, which is an Icelandic instrument, or an instrument used in Iceland, which wasn't an instrument I'd come across before. For those people who don't know, a horizontal guitar or horizontal violin or cello with a number of strings that you can either pluck and you can alter the tone of the strings and you can bow. But I like the idea of this young man starting off and having a bad, you know, a bad start in life. He'd lost his father, and his stepfather wasn't nice, and then loses his mother. And so then he has to go on a journey. So he can, classic hero's journey, you know, it may as well have been to claim the hand of the princess, but it wasn't. It was his beloved's father, to give him permission to marry his beloved. And of course, you know, as you know, as the story unfolds, yes, a little step, one more step into the shadow, one more step away from the light and into the darkness, bit by bit by bit, without him ever really doing anything particularly wicked or evil, except perhaps towards the end. But until trying to be successful and trying to become prosperous so he can go back and demonstrate his ability to earn, so that he can support his beloved and, you know, their children and family to be, that takes him into the shadows and into the darkness. But almost in a way that he doesn't really think that it's wicked or evil. He's not a kind of, and now for the necromancy, raise them. It's none of that. It's like, oh, wow, yes, this will help me, that will help me, this will help me. And nobody gets hurt along the way, except perhaps right towards the end. Yeah. Yeah, my story.
Well, it was really good, really good. And I love the way you really brought the audience into that medieval 12th century-ish Iceland, because of course so many people think of Vikings, think of Scandinavia, but not many people think, oh yes, they did actually do anything Norse in Iceland.
Yeah.
And of course Iceland do have a thing even now for fairy mounds, like they will, I believe it's true, unless it's an urban myth, that they'll direct a road around the fairy mound instead of bulldozing over the fairy mound. So they kind of had those superstitions and beliefs. I really like how you drew that in, especially when you described the hero kind of like going into the wilder parts of Iceland, away from where the people and the villages are, and encountering trolls and hearing the pipe and the flute and everything and the music. And your actual kind of vocal talent, it was truly something to behold. I mean, not just like doing the voices, but doing the sound effects and the music. And going on to our next story, which is, because you told two that night, the next one was about a shield maiden, which of course got made up because of course women love stories about women and women heroes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And shield maidens are the flavour of the month when it comes with Vikings.
Very much.
That was also really interesting, especially there's so few stories from the actual sources about the goddesses doing anything besides Freya crying tears of gold and sleeping with the dwarves to get a necklace, and Frigg telling everyone to stop hurting Balder. And Idun turning into an acorn. That's about it, really. Apart from Hel. Yeah. Hel's just Hel. Bless her, she just got cursed down for being herself.
Yeah.
That's it. There's no other stories about them, whereas all the male gods have loads of adventures.
Yes.
And so I was really excited to hear, because obviously he didn't reveal it was Freya until the end. That was a beautiful kind of like pull along. But I thought that was really well told, that one. And so I would love to know more about how you came up with that story.
There's lots of different things in there, and I think that the main character was inspired by somebody I know, just sort of physically, and then I don't know, I'm trying to remember about how she all sort of came together, and all the things. I think what I wanted to do was I wanted to have a strong female. I wanted this. I didn't set out to say I want a strong female character. I'm going to do this. It was just I was aware that there was this potential character there, and then I've learned over the years. I think quite a lot of my stories start off tragically, and they might end up happily, or they might end up tragically as well. And so both those stories I told that night is, you know. The young man finds it difficult and his stepfather dies and he's alone in the world with only a musical instrument and a small bag of money and a denial from his potential father-in-law to marry his love. And then within the Shield Maiden, starting off with her seeing her husband being killed and seeing her child being killed, which is also it can be a difficult story to start sometimes because I'm not sure adults always understand that. Yes, of course, you know, stories can start. Lots of stories, films, books, plays, whatever, TV series start off with something awful. But when somebody is standing there and describing how, you know, a little child is killed by some awful raiders, by some awful Vikings, and that kicks the story off, because I can see the audience. I can see sometimes there's a kind of a. You know, no, he's not going to do this. Sure, he's not going to kill the child. Is he? Oh God, he has. Oh God, he's dead. And you can see sort of very early on, people are, and there's a little bit of, and I have to be very careful to manage that. So it's not done in an offensive or titillating way that people kind of feel, oh, and especially of course, if people who have lost loved ones or lost children or siblings, you know, young siblings, I have to be gentle with that and carry them on to the next part so that they see there is, oh, okay, here's a doorway to the next part of the story. And this is part of the story. This is not just gratuitous murder of everyone. Because there is also a bit where, in that very beginning, after the husband has been killed and the child has been killed, in which these raiders, how do I put this? One of them forces himself upon her. And I have to get the audience to understand that without getting into detail, which nobody wants to hear and would make everybody feel very uncomfortable. And also as a man telling it becomes extra difficult. And so I have to kind of make sure the audience understand what's going on, what's about to happen, or what could happen. And then she kills him and there's a moment of, and I've actually had people in the audience go, kills him as a kind of like, you know, that's a kind of a steam release of the release valve of everything that's happened then. And then things become sort of drawn out. There's lots of bits of folklore in there. I also wanted her to not be a sort of wailing widow, sort of dragging herself through the bad lands of the world. And so when she turns up at the nobleman's house and she wins the wrestling competition because she fights Scott, and at the end of the evening, because he sort of said, well, why don't you stay here and keep me warm? And all the adults, anybody over a certain age in the room can understand what he means. And at the end, he does sleep at the bottom of the bed because he's lost. But then they keep each other warm later in the night. And it's a way of kind of like, yes, she's lost the love of her life, but her life hasn't ended. And her life hasn't ended as a woman, as an individual, as a loving, caring person with needs and passions. And that can be okay. And then she goes off on her journey. And that's just a kind of a little kind of bit. So I wanted her to be able to, again, this is me sort of perhaps retrospectively thinking, I didn't set this out to say, these are the points I want to hit. But I felt that her character was strong enough so that when she had to got over the grief and made the decision to go out into the world and to go and die gloriously in battle so she could find her husband and daughter, then she was allowed to do all sorts of things of fighting, feasting, and the other one that she could enjoy, the third, frolicking, let's say, and enjoy her life as well as being a strong character.
Well, you did tell it and handled those delicate subjects really, really well. I mean, it's interesting now that you've talked about it, kind of like when we think back to some of the Norse stories are quite dark. I mean, Odin gets off with a lot of giantesses on his way and Loki does his thing as a horse. And Freya, she sleeps around with dwarves, but kind of like there's also kind of like beheadings. Like I remember learning about the story where Odin tricks a load of, I think they're giants, or at least some kind of dumb type characters in a field with, and he gives them a magic whetstone, he makes them all super sharp, and then they all accidentally behead each other as they're sheathing the wheat, kind of thing. And I thought, that's actually really cruel.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's overly manipulative, cruel, but that's just who Odin is. And I think that's something that Marvel has definitely taken out of. Yeah. They've taken a lot of the darkness out because they want their classic superhero. They want the classical villain, which is why it irks me still that they've given Loki horns and then Hela horns. Just as that kind of like symbolism of evilness. But then in a way, kind of like when I think back to Beowulf, that's got lots of dark stuff in it. And yet that was being told probably around the fires for ages. So it's almost like stories help us look at these dark things and confront them or accept them or learn to understand why they are that dark, perhaps.
Absolutely.
Or almost like learn a lesson from them. As you say, kind of like with your first story about the man, kind of like always one step from evil. Kind of, there's always like some kind of almost like a lesson and a message behind each story, which has probably been universally true for most stories, I think, because they help us all empathize with another. They help us put ourselves in those places, in those shoes, and in these times, because these stories are set in times, if not worlds, very much different to our own.
I think I read an article a little while back in the New Scientist magazine, and that was talking about how reading fiction helps with empathy and understanding and human communication, because precisely that. So that engaging with fiction can safely take us to places that we perhaps should never and hopefully will never go, but it does prepare us for those things. And it is that I think we've become a little bit sort of, I think, since the I don't know, it's probably throughout history, but I think of things like the Grimm's fairy tales, where the brothers Grimm, who didn't write them, collected them from lots of different people, and actually a lot of them from the woman who lived next door, and then one of the brothers married her, and she still doesn't get a mention. It's always the brothers Grimm. Some of the earlier cuts of those, the earlier ones, even though they're still tidied up, are still pretty gruesome, and then they get less gruesome as people's sensibilities and that very sort of 19th century Victorian morality comes in, even though it may well be a double morality of this is what we say we do and actually this is what we really do in private, or you know, to the poor or to women or whatever, but you know, this public morality. And then, of course, coming into the first part of the 20th century, and then Disney took them and polished them even further. We've stepped away from a lot of those things. And when I tell stories to children, if they are gruesome or horrible, it's usually the adults who are looking at their child and looking at me and looking at the child, looking at me and looking at the child, and looking at me. Whereas the child's just quite happily sort of sitting there. And it's sort of, it's like the cartoon violence. It's not real. Understand what's happening, and yes, there are moralities and there are lessons, but it is that point of when, if we can face the darkness in our imagination, that helps us to deal with the darkness in our real life, should we encounter any. Otherwise we've got nothing to call on, we've got no examples, no points of reference to do that with. Talking of the brothers Grimm, I'm researching researching some stories for a show I'm going to be doing in a couple of weeks with my big sister. It's actually on the 18th of May, online or watch later. People want to, and it's called Tales from the Haunted Bakery. And it should be, you know, nice, sort of slightly kind of funny, dark, sort of dark fairy tales, sort of light horror sort of thing, with quite a lot of comedy in it. But I came across, I was looking for stories, and I came across a Grimm's collected fairy tale that was in the first edition of their collection, but didn't make it to any of the others. And it's called something like The Two Brothers Who Played at Slaughter. And in the story, two brothers see a butcher slaughtering a pig, and they decided that they will have a go at this. And there are a few different versions, but basically one is the butcher and one is the pig. And the mother looks out of the window as she's bathing the baby and sees one of the boys cutting the throat of the other one. And so she immediately rushes down to try and stop this. It's too late. He's cut his brother's throat. And so she hangs him, the other boy, for cutting his brother's throat, only, of course, then to realize that the baby left back in the house has drowned in the bathwater.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, that's basically the story. But this is a folk tale, a fairy tale. And it hasn't made it past the first edition because obviously it's far too gruesome. And to be honest, it's not much of a story beyond the if you happen to see your children slitting each other's throats, make sure you don't leave the baby in the bath when you go to hang the other one. But that's a particularly gruesome version. But some of the fairy tales, Charles Perrault, who wrote or collected Red Riding Hood and Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty, Sleeping Beauty, the bit where she marries the prince is only half the story. She stays in the castle as a sort of secret wife until eventually his father dies. He becomes king. His wife and two children go and join them. But his mother is an ogre. And so when he goes off to war, he has to hide his wife and children because she wants to eat them. She then finds them and then instructs a servant to kill one of the children and to cook it. He, of course, doesn't. He hides the child and cooks cooks some venison instead, and goes to the second one, goes, and then she thinks she's eaten both children and what was Sleeping Beauty, only to discover them, of course, as they're arguing one day, and she's about to lower them into a cauldron full of poisonous snakes and toads and venomous snakes and toads and whatnots, when the prince turns up, sees it's his mother, she's horrified at being caught out and jumps into the cauldron, killing herself with the venomous snakes and toads, whatever. And then, and only then, does the prince, Sleeping Beauty, and their two children live happily ever after. But you know, that's been totally
wow,
yeah, you don't see that one in Disney.
No, even I don't. I mean, I've got a 4-year-old, well, 4.5-year-old now, going on 13 with the level of sass and attitude I got this morning.
Oh, very good. Yeah.
And I remember kind of like her reward from the Tooth Fairy for giving up her dummies 2 years plus ago was a nice collection of fairy tales. Uh-huh. And it was only upon reading them to Naomi that I kind of like, I was like, a lot of the bad guys are either witches or evil stepmothers. There's not many bad men.
No, of course.
There's always princes or nice kings.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting. Because I've certainly been dabbling myself, I've been reading, if that's more correct, some Norse folk tales. I don't know if you've ever come across this book before.
I know it. I've not read it. I've seen it, but I've not read it, yes.
It's interesting. It's certainly interesting. It has echoes of kind of fairies and pixies and elves and gnomes and dwarves, and it makes me think that yes, it's reminiscent of English folklore and fairy tales, but it's very distinctly different. I mean, the last story I read was called Prince Lindworm.
Oh yes.
Which was, it was strangely reminiscent of Rapunzel, in that the queen had to eat some flowers in order to have a baby because she wasn't conceiving naturally for whatever reason.
Yes.
And she meets an old hag, as you do in the woods, and the old hag says, you eat this one for a girl, this one for a boy, but don't eat two. She of course picks one after a lot of thought and decides it's quite tasty, she might as well eat the other one.
Yeah.
As you do. And so 9 months went by, she gives birth first to the Lindworm, but he slithers out so quick and out of the room and beyond that no one sees him apart from the mum.
Yeah.
So she thinks she's just hallucinating in the midst of childbirth and produce the second son.
Yeah.
But then when the second son wants to get married, they keep finding that the Lindworm, who's a lot bigger now, keeps blocking off all the roads, preventing him going to see any princess. He goes, no, I'm the firstborn, you need to find a wife for me.
Yeah.
And the king's like, oh, all right then, I'll write to this far off land, they'll send me their daughter. If I don't tell them it's a Lindworm, she'll come. Of course they don't, I mean, she comes.
They'll probably never notice, yeah.
I know, she discovers him at the wedding, doesn't flee, she goes through with it, and the Lindworm eats her, and then this keeps happening, and eventually all the other kings say, nope, we're not sending you our daughters now, because I've heard so-and-so's daughter never came back, and so-and-so's daughter never came back. So the king is bereft, he goes to a goat's herd, and says, look, I will give you all the wealth I have in my kingdom if your daughter will just go marry this Lindworm, so it will just leave us alone, so we can get my son a nice wife. The daughter, of course, gets bereft about her fate to be, because her father is lured and pressured by the king. And she meets the same hag in the woods. And he goes, oh, I can solve your problem for you too. She tells her to wear 10 shifts, like snake skins for the Lindworm. It's on their wedding night, because she goes through with it. So the Lindworm says, will you get into bed? And he goes, I'll get into bed if you shed one of your skins. And so they do. And so they keep going through the cycle of shedding skins together. And then when he's basically stripped bare, she has to thrash him with a whip and then bathe him in milk And right. then she can cuddle him in bed, and then the next day he's a beautiful prince.
All right.
And then she's happy because she's got her prince, and she can have all yeah. the wealth, and she's now a princess, and everyone's happy. I thought, that's really rather gruesome, actually, kind of like Emsley having to shed the skin and then thrush a light giant lindworm.
It's not like they're ever going to get better. It's kind of like, oh, okay, basically I've changed now. I've stopped my my matricidal cannibalistic ways. Is it matricide? Is that right? Yeah.
I don't know. I'm rubbish with words.
That's been killings of mothers. I think what spouse, I call them the spouses, but yes. But yeah, I've stopped eating my wives now. And yeah, okay, all right, we'll be happy. But again, there's a number that's like the Arabian Nights, 1001 Arabian Nights, the sultan who marries and then kills and then after the wedding night kills his wife in the morning every day, and it's only Scheherazade who says, "Well, let me tell you a story," and he says, "Oh, I want to know the ending of that. Well, I'll tell you tomorrow," and she keeps spinning it out for 1001 nights every night. That eventually goes, "All right, I won't murder you then. I'll keep you," you know. Oh, how lovely. There's a lot of those things you mentioned earlier, by the way, about stepmothers. In a lot of the earlier recordings of fairy tales, it's not stepmothers, it's just mothers.
Ugh.
That makes it even worse. But then I think, yes, it kind of got cleaned up. We can't possibly say that mothers do this. Mothers would never do that. Stepmother, there we go, wicked stepmother. So before that, yeah, it's women, basically. Women.
There is certainly an issue of what some academics have called kind of like the male gaze and kind of like stories being decided and determined by men. I mean, I think this is one thing I've certainly learnt in my research on Valkyrie, is that some scholars have a big chip on the shoulder of term with Snorri Sturluson, because of course he's the most famous one of all for writing down these Norse myths. But he was a Christian and he was a man, and he chose what he chose. He didn't write all of them down by any means. He selected. It was a compilation, not a full collection.
Yeah.
And it was for a purpose, because he was writing it as a book to give to a certain prince, I think, to help him learn the ways of being a king and connect with his heritage. So it had that whole agenda behind it. Yeah. It was certainly, that's what made me interesting when kind of like, of course, Disney/Marvel decided to retell Sleeping Beauty through Maleficent's experience, and then they did Maleficent 2, which was even more enlightening, because they really switched it round and kind of made an evil queen that wasn't Maleficent. But beyond that, they've not done much more, although I know the recent revival of Snow White as a live action version has split the critics, because it's two stories in one, really, because they've got Rebels and then they've got Snow White's evil queen with some kind of backstory to help justify her evilness.
I've not
brought myself to see it, but
no, nor have I. I just saw a lot of people going woke, and I just didn't again. In Snow White, it's become Disney cleaned it up to this idea of, you know, the prince coming along and finding her and falling in love with her and then seeing her dead in the coffin and giving her a magic kiss to bring her back to life. But in some of the earlier versions, the evil queen is her mother, and who is jealous of her daughter's beauty, and poisons her with the apple, which gets lodged in her throat and she dies. And the dwarves put her in a crystal coffin, and they determine to look after her because she was wonderful and lived with them and looked after them. A prince turns up, sees a beautiful corpse in a glass coffin, and thinks, "Oh, I'd like that." He says, "Can I have it?" And they say, no, we're the caretakers of this. You can't possibly have it. And he says, "What about a lot of money?" And they go, "Okay, you can have it." And he takes the glass coffin, and it's only when on the way back to his homeland, the cart bumps or breaks and the coffin falls off and the lid slides off, that he then thinks, "Do you know what? I think I'll just kiss this corpse, because it's a very beautiful corpse." Nothing about it is then purely incidental, or he doesn't know that she's going to wake up. So it's just the prince, you know, kissing the dead body of a beautiful young woman, and then she wakes up, coughs out the bit of poisoned apple. Then he says, "Oh, how lovely, you're alive. That's a bonus." You know, quite happy when she was dead. "Will you marry me?" "Yes, I'd love to marry you." "Let's get married." "Well, we should invite everybody." "Well, why don't we invite my mother, stepmother?" And they do, and she comes along to the wedding party, and then is put in red hot iron shoes, and they watch as she dances herself to death.
That's not in my daughter's story. The choking apple, well, the apple choking bit is.
Yeah.
which is what my daughter picked up. She goes, that doesn't happen in the film though, does it, Mum? I said, no, she doesn't choke. She swallows the apple, darling, and it's the spell that puts her to sleep. But yeah, but like when you think about it so starkly as an adult, like, yeah, he's just walking around and then kissing a beautiful woman, dead or alive, which does.
What a lovely bit of necrophilia. That's right. Yeah, she seems to be quite well preserved. Why not? I'll have a snog with a corpse. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. Here's a large amount of money for me to take that corpse off your hand. And the dwarves go, yeah, right, go on then. So it's very weird, but. I think one of the things about stories and the more magical they get is there's sometimes things are just bizarre in the stories and it just helps to plot along. And sometimes you have to sort of let go of the don't pull at the thread. Don't kind of go, why did the prince want a dead woman? And why is he kissing a dead woman in the knowledge that she's dead? Not that this is a magic spell that will wake her, but that she's just don't pull at that. Don't pull at that thread. There is an element of I just have to accept this as the story goes on, and it's helping the story move from place to place. And again, quite possibly because the original storytellers, the original the bards, the writers, the chroniclers, even though it was mouth to ear to mouth to ear, would have kind of gone, how do I get from here to there? So we'll just do that, and everyone's okay. We'll just accept that. We will suspend our disbelief and our criticisms and just go with, all right, that happened. We've got to the next part of the story.
Well, I think you and possibly some of our viewers and listeners might appreciate this book if they just like some short stories that are very different to English folk and fairy tales. It's Viking Folk and Fairy Tales from Flame Tree Press. They're fabled folklore and ancient stories.
That's a whole
very fancy edition. I got this in Norway last year.
Nice. Lovely.
So yes, it's certainly interesting. I'm only kind of like even a third of the way through it because there's lots of stories. And there's one so far that I've come across that matches kind of like with the pantheon of characters from the mythology. But the rest have all been very much about princes or kings or princesses and trolls and ogres and all sorts of wicked dealings and curses of three or breaking things. But it's interesting. And I wonder if you've ever come across the Cursed Sword of Tirfing tale in your readings. Oh,
no,
you must. It's a wonderful tale. I haven't actually got like a book version of it, but I know it must be written down somewhere. Because our previous guests on the Legends of Jorvik miniseries, the Time Will Tell Theatre, did a wonderful dramatisation of that as the finale show for the Jorvik festival this year.
Yeah.
And it's all about a king who finds some dwarves, prevents them from going home, says, you want to make me a brilliant sword, a sword that can kill anyone and anything, and it must be gold and have a ruby in the hilt.
Lovely.
I said, okay, we'll go do it. And they secretly do it, but put curses into it, that it will that it must always taste blood when it's unsheathed, and it will do three evil deeds in its lifetime. And there's a wonderful female shield maiden character in the entire arc because it travels through generation after generation, this sword, and into all sorts of hands and families, causing all sorts of tragedy, trauma and mischief and lots of bloodshed as part of the curse. But it's full of draugr and spells and curses and brother betraying brother or that kind of thing. And there is actually one element that features a bit of kind of a storytelling within the story, in that one guy who then becomes a king once he gets the sword, decides to dispense justice by way of people proving their innocence. And this one guy had done something so horribly wrong, he had to prove his innocence, but he couldn't work out how, so he prayed to Odin for a miracle, and Odin said, that's all right, I'll go in your stead. I'll prove my innocence by giving you a riddle you cannot solve, dear king. And he gives him riddle after riddle. The king proves clever and answers some of them. And then, of course, Odin does what Odin does, which is a bit of a show off, which is say, what does Odin whisper into his dead son Balder's ear on his funeral pyre? And the king thinks long and hard. He goes, aha, only Odin knows that, which means you're Odin. And then Odin curses him again over because he tried to then kill Odin in the attack of Revelation.
What's that story called again? What's it called again?
The Cursed Sword Tirfing.
Cursed Sword Tirfing.
Tirfing.
Yeah.
But it's Tirfing, definitely an Old Norse saga somewhere, definitely an Old Norse story, and it was beautifully adapted. I've only come across it in one element that deals with the shield maiden Hervor, who discovers that she is a shield maiden by birth because she was a a slave labour worker to begin with, because her dad got cursed and killed by the sword originally. So she goes, right, I'm going to claim my heritage. She goes into his burial mound and touches the sword. He rises up all undead, says, no, don't take the sword, dear daughter. It'll bring bloodshed and horror. She goes, no, I'm going to do my heritage and do you proud, daddy, and I'm going to go off with this sword. And of course, things happen to her later family later on that, of course, the result of her taking the sword. But I came across her character because I read a book about the forgotten history of warrior women by Nancy Marie Brown called The Real Valkyrie. And she uses her as a kind of a narrative figure to explore all these all this evidence that she finds of warrior women in Norse society up and down, kind of like the Dnieper and Birka and that journey towards Constantinople. So, but there was much more to the story that I did not know. So it was wonderfully told. And you can actually go watch it all on YouTube, Jason. And they recorded it all, and it's on the YouTube channel. I will put the link in the blurb below, and I'll email it to you, Jason.
Yeah, fantastic. great. Yeah, that sounds great. It reminds me also of a lot of those. Thinking about the sword, it reminds me of lots of cursed, you know, the cursed sword idea, and particularly. I don't know if he writes so much now, but certainly during the 60s and 70s, an author called Michael Moorcock. Who wrote prolifically. He was one of those guys who was sort of the editor of Tarzan comic magazine when he was, I don't know, 5 years old. He was very young anyway, and then was, you know, constantly churning stuff out. And then he wrote a lot of stuff. I think certain enhancements were used during his writing process, shall we say, to encourage his imagination. But it was the 60s and the 70s. But there is, and in it, there's a lot of stuff to do with law and chaos. Those are two big sort of things. And in fact, that eight-pointed chaos star comes from his books that we now kind of see everywhere, the eight-pointed chaos star. And a lot of it is characters and people overlapping. This is idea of the eternal champion, and so in lots of different planes and lots of different times there's this person, and they are all aspects of the same thing. And there's one particular one called Elric, and he is they're called Melniboneans in the stories, but basically they're like dark elves. They are beautiful but wicked and evil, and there's only this last little island left of them. And once upon a time they rode dragons through the skies. George R. R. Martin, where did you get that from? And they were dragons through the skies, and they dealt with the gods of chaos, and now they just sort of devolved into a sort of indulgent, decadent society. But one of their emperors, Elric, is born albino and with a blood deficiency that means he's very weak, and he has to keep taking potions to keep him enough energy. And everybody thinks he's not really right for emperor because he's not, you know, he's not strong enough. And then eventually he summons the great chaos god that gives him a sword called Stormbringer. And Stormbringer, every time it is unsheathed, it wants to taste blood. And if it cuts or kills, then it drains the life force and passes some of that on to Elric. And of course, what starts off as a wonderful sword in battle, oh, suddenly I'm terribly strong, and even wearing Stormbringer by my side gives me strength, means that at some point it will leap into his hand and kill because it is thirsty. And of course, he kills friends and relatives and lovers, and it all goes horribly wrong. And yes, at some point he gets involved in a battle where the more he kills, the more energy he has, and the more energy he has, the more he can kill, and so it becomes this impossible killing machine. But it is this this double-edged sword, I was going to say, the curse of the swords, where it gives you great power, but at the same time it has its own agendas or its own life or its own curses or its own direction, and you are not the master of that magical weapon. You are given privileges and gifts by it, but it is in control of you ultimately and chooses where and when to act to properly plop on your life.
Cursed objects, that's a whole other
Treasure
show. I mean, that's making me think obviously back to the Snark of the Balsam and the Ring of the Nibelungs with the Ring of Fafnir's Hoard, the cursed ring, which I'm actually going to go see the second opera of on Wednesday night this week.
All 16 hours of it, or just a kind of part of it?
Well, it's 5 hours and 45 minutes is the Valkyrie part of the cycle, and of course it's the Valkyrie, which is my catnip for Norse mythology. And as I've spent months in the Valkyrie headspace, I need to honour it by going actually seeing it, seeing me, I've written so much about it, and how it all started off with not just Wagner, but primarily his overlooked costume designer, Emil Doepler, who really set the whole image of the Valkyrie up, and then that's just stuck ever since.
Oh,
just
is like that the kind of have stuck. Curly things and horn helmets.
The winged helmets, yeah. The kind of like the female breastplates, the spears, yeah. The shields, the flowing cloaks.
Yeah.
I mean, the winged helmets is the one motif that's really stuck with them, just like the horned helmets have really stuck with the Vikings. Yeah. And again, it was just a costume design. It was a piece at that time, just romanticization. Can't even say the word. Romanticization. I do have an English degree, ladies and listeners. I just can't speak it at all.
Romanticization. I can't say it either. Romantic. Yeah, they've made it romantic. They romanticized it.
Because, of course, in some of the sagas, like there's Njal's saga, which is about a man either traveling to or going from a battle in Clontarf in Ireland, and he finds a cottage and he sees three women and riders ride into that cottage and then stop and they go in, and he peeks in and they're definitely Valkyries because they're weaving on a loom made of men's guts.
Ooh.
And weighted with men's skulls, and the shuttle is like a spearhead or a sword blade, and they're saying, oh, we're going to take that one and this one, and this is all going to happen at the Battle of Clontarf, and then they decide what they're going to do with it, and then they ride off with it and go to that battle and do their choosing. And that is such a really dark, gritty, gruesome, dirty depiction of Valkyries compared to how people imagine them as stupid.
Yeah.
Exactly. Kind of like large breasted women, flowing hair, beautiful, kind of like no sign of blood or grim or dirt on them at all. Which is why I'm slightly excited to see this latest iteration of the cycle, especially the Valkyrie, because I've seen some preview shots coming up through kind of like from previewers and reviewers, and it is kind of like in a present day type setting, so there's no winged helmets or anything, in fact no armor, but they are definitely not clean. They look like they've been through a wildfire, because that's the kind of setting of the battle, is like a wildfire burnt landscape, so they're collecting ashes more than actual bodies, which is that's what I've heard. So hopefully I might put together a little review on that once I've been in scene and lived through all 5 hours and 45 minutes of it.
Yeah,
they are streaming it, thankfully, the Royal British Opera, to lots of cinemas around up and down the country, so as long as you can afford a cinema ticket, you can go and see it without having to travel all the way down to the Royal British Opera House.
Yes,
which I can't afford to, so
no, quite. That sounds but there is something, I think you're right, there is that romanticize. I can't, I want to get that word out now, romanticize. there is a kind of a, there's that, it's that polishing idea. We've kind of got away from the sort of, I mean, more recently, probably the last sort of 20 odd years, I suppose, you've kind of got depictions of warfare, melee war, hand-to-hand combat warfare, which have moved away from Errol Flynn, ding, 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 where you're kind of saber fencing and then, or under the arm and someone falls over and there's a bit of tomato sauce on the end of the sword, to kind of heading towards more and more visceral depictions of what it's actually like, and more archaeological evidence being sort of commonly shown. You know, you're like, well, here's a skull, this person must have died in battle, because you can see that their nose is missing, and in fact the word we can see here was they were hit in the face with a battle axe, not cleanly beheaded or stuck under the arm or poked in the chest. The person was smashed in the face with an axe, which may well have killed them instantly, or may well have put them on their back as they slowly bled to death. You know, these awful things. War is awful. And it is. And of course, we say that war is glorious. And of course, we have to tell people who we want to go and fight wars, that war is glorious. Because if we said, oh, God, you can end up with your guts hanging out in the desert and it'll take you days to die, nobody really wants to hear that side of thing. And you need that idea of a heroic culture if you want people to stand up and go out and fight and be prepared to die. So when you've got this, you know, you're talking about the Valkyries and covered in ash and, you know, from the smoke of battle, absolutely people would have been covered in all sorts of things that have come out of people's bodies, being poked out, and yeah, and the trophies they would have taken as well. And it's not always a clean stab under the arm. Awful things people would have done to each other so that they would have finished that person or made sure they survived. Because if it's a fight between the two of you and you've got to grab hold of something and pull it off or pull it out or bite it off or gouge it up, you know, you'll do that.
It's something I've certainly noticed when I first started reading historical fiction set in the Viking Age, that especially starting off with Bernard Cornwall, who is a legend in his own right in terms of what he's done for the Viking Age in terms of historical fiction with his Uhtred series, they've always made it really clear that kind of like being in the Shield Wall, yes, it was an honour of pride and some bravery, but it was also the worst position to be in because you're there where all the blades are and you're chipping over dead bodies and you've got your friends dying around you and there's arrows. Yeah. They, just like you are with your storytelling, they really kind of like bring it to the fore of like, okay, this is what's happening. But because it's in a book and it's long ago and we don't do Shield Wall warfare anymore, we kind of, as readers, we're okay to that. But I guess it's possibly why so many people like to read crime fiction where there are horrible murders going on and there's like blood all over the crime scene.
Yeah.
It's kind of like filling in that gap almost that we have lost from other forms of storytelling.
And I think people enjoy that, the thrill of danger and horror. I was sort of Christopher Lee talking about horror a little while back,
talking in his very fruity voice about saying, yes, because of course we can enjoy that and understand that it is a story and we can be part of that story, and yet that story is distant from us.
And we can dip into those things. There's a slight sort of, there's a voyeuristic element to it that we can enjoy the crime, we can enjoy the murders, we can enjoy, you know, the brutality of war. It's interesting, I find myself more and more watching stuff that on when I'm watching a TV or watching a film, and the older I get now going, whereas once upon a time I would have been, you know, and I'm still enjoying it, but I'm like, oh dear, oh no, you know, that watching some awful wound being inflicted on someone. And maybe it is that this is someone's PhD, of course, but, you know, we need to understand that as when we are younger, we are much more open and thrilled by the idea of damage, warfare and wounding, because those are the people we need to get up and fight. If we need fighters, we need fit young people to stand up and fight. There's no point some old geezer like me standing up and fighting than some 20-year-old leaping around like a flea, zipping around me. By this point, I should have bought an enormous suit of armor or have an army standing in front of me. You know, I don't do the fighting anymore. I do the pointing at my age. But we need it's the younger people who are more willing to engage in those things. I don't know. That's just pure off the top of my head speculation. But it's one of those things, being as a performance storyteller, telling stories to people, because you're sort of acting it out and without hamming it up. I don't know if you've ever seen the very early Buffy the Vampire Slayer film with Donald Sutherland as the big evil vampire. There's a great vampire death scene that goes on for about 5 or 10 minutes with the vampire just going, and it goes in lots of our action and cuts back to him, and he's still going, but without, you know, hamming it up and making it ridiculous. There are things that, you know, you're describing to people, and because people are sitting down and listening to stories and listening to someone talking to them, if it's someone who has managed to capture the audience, and there are a lot of storytellers who are very good at remembering stories but not very good at telling them and engaging people, two different but related parts, then by that point people are willing to collude with you and listen to what you say and just take it on board, because they have kind of gone, brilliant, this is a story, I'm not being convinced to do anything, I'm not at personal risk, so I can sit here and I can kind of open up my mind and allow myself to become suggestible in this in this space, in this theatrical space and time. But those are the bits where you can talk about somebody dying or being wounded, and you can watch the audience going, they probably don't know they're doing it. Ooh. You know, that the face of the, you know, empathizing with the character who's been wounded, hurt or whatever, or either that or yes, you know, and people you would perhaps normally think wouldn't have gone, go on, yeah, go on. You can see people really nodding and becoming you know, part of the sort of the narrative experience. I suppose it's a bit like, I often sort of think sometimes when I'm telling stories and if I'm talking and I do this and I start nodding, and like you're doing now, you're nodding back because I'm not yeah, you're mirroring me because we're chatting. But when I do it with an audience and I can see people doing it, and I think if I were a stage hypnotist, I'd pick you and you. Those are the people who really, you know, they're listening, they're in, they're suggestible, they're properly deeply in there. And whether they're particularly suggestible or whether they have allowed themselves to open up, you know, given themselves permission to do that. But it changes the kind of the psychological experience. And I often hear when people come out of storytelling shows, for a start, they kind of say, I didn't know what to expect, or I thought it was going to be a talk. But people say, oh, I could see all the pictures. I could see, you know, and they could see that. I suggest the pictures to people. And so long as I don't conflict with what they're thinking or what their references are, if I were able to see the projections, you know, out of someone's forehead style, I would see slightly different pictures from everybody, but similar things, and people bringing in their own references to color in the edges and supply the details for things, because it's the audience that actually produces the pictures that I sort of, or storyteller describes.
If someone invented a machine that could project our imaginations, I'd worry for you as a profession, because it's almost like our best kept secret. It's like no one can use our imagination, it's only us.
Yeah,
it's certainly
yeah.
Why I'm interested in a new game that's come out called Split Fiction, which is about a sci-fi universe capturing the imaginations from writers in some kind of virtual reality bubble, and then making it into a virtual world, so have a virtual story instead of a readable story.
Yeah.
But these two, characters get crossed up, so then they each experience their own stories. It's a co-op player. It looks really fun. It's got some great reviews. So like one's selling fantasy, one's selling a sci-fi, and they're both very distinctly different characters, but they've all got their own messages and issues hidden behind their own stories.
Yeah.
And something. I want to play it. I just need someone to play it with. And time. I need time to play it as well.
Is that a computer game or a board game?
A computer game called Split Fiction. It's on Steam. I think it's also on console. And it also works on cross-platform. So if you had a console and I have my gaming laptop,
you
could still play it, provided one of us had the friends pass that enables the other one to show up.
Needs to come to join.
But it looks really good. And I like how the actual imagination part and the storytelling part has been explored in the very visual sense and through a co-op game of all things, because of course games themselves are stories, we just have to play complete levels through. But in terms of retelling stories, it's also made me think of the Netflix film Damsel. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
No,
that's a really interesting take on the damsel of being a maiden, but also an issue of a king and queen having a problem with the dragon and having to send princesses off to the dragon. But then the princess learns why the dragon is the way she is, because it's not a he dragon, it's a she dragon. And there's this whole kind of issue of revenge, both from the human side and the dragon side. And it's a nice twist at the end, I think, in that sees both the princess and the dragon get their rightful ending, I suppose. It's not quite fairy tale, but it's dark in places, because the character who played, well, the woman who plays her is the woman who plays 11 in Stranger Things. Yes, she does really well. I mean, she's also in like the Sherlock Holmes spin-off, which I never actually got to see either. But she does really well in that, because a lot of it's basically, she's almost like a fantasy version of Lara Croft, in that she's shoved into a place where she's got to survive by her own wit and will and cunning and cleverness. And it turns out she's not too bad as a survivalist. But yeah, it was really, really interesting how that came out. So I do recommend people, if they want to explore how people are trying to retell these tales and almost like different points of view, which is the other thing about storytelling, is just different points of view. All of it is just different points of view. So I I really like that one. I love dragons.
After Damsel, lovely.
Damsel.
And I like Millie Bobby Brown as well. I like saying Millie Bobby Brown as well. It's a very satisfying name to say, Millie Bobby Brown. In terms of, you just talked about different perspectives and different different viewpoints. It's one of the things that I sometimes come across in the performance storytelling world is that people sort of saying, "Well, that's not the story," or "Why are you telling that?" or "Why did you say that? What did you do that with the story?" or "This story, is it one of yours? Is it a new one? So it's not an old story," and this kind of in some quarters or some people, of course, people are people and some people are great, some people are idiots, wherever you go. But there is, I think there's with some people, there's a difficulty of separating the difference between curating folklore and stories and myth and legend, which is one thing, you know, yes, we must record these things, we must keep these things, but also the idea that stories didn't stop. There wasn't a point when someone said, "All right, we've finished. Brothers Grimm are dead, are they? Right, well, that's canon." Stop. And so I think some people find it difficult or challenging when you take a story and you either change it or adapt it or completely rethink it. And in June this year, I'm going to be collaborating with a storyteller called Dave Tong, who's a brilliant bloke. He does loads of medieval and Tudor tales, and his background, he went back to academia as an adult. Partly through his storytelling, and he does lots of, you know, he's got all the kind of the kit and the costume, and had to go to the College of Heralds in London for them to sign off that it was the right stuff and things. And apparently he walked into this room, and you know, he had all the bits and pieces and there with him, and he's ready for this interview and to tell people that, and the guy went, "Yeah, that was good." Was that what an anticlimax? But he and I are doing a version of the Canterbury Tales, so, you know, medieval English stories. And because there's certainly the references there, it's a bunch of people talking about their own experiences. And whilst people are millers or sumners, things that don't exist or aren't trades that we would easily recognise these days, knights, someone whose trade is a knight, the stories are just of ordinary people, and they're funny as well, and they've got loads of bum jokes in it. It's absolutely full of bum jokes, and people don't kind of think, well, it's always medieval stuff, it'll all be holier than thou. No, there's just loads of bum and fart jokes in it. So we our show is called Canterbury Tales Reshod: Piety, Pokers and Posteriors. We've had sort of, you know, put a little kind of warning in there that it's not, you know, yes, this is culture, yes, this is high culture reinterpretation of medieval literature with plenty of bum jokes in it, because that's what Chaucer put in there, because people then found them funny and people find them funny today. It's the same.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, there is humour, I think, albeit of a different kind, found within the Norse mythology stories. Yeah. I mean, my favourite, of course, has to be the Lay of Thrym, when Thor has to go in bridal gown to get his hammer back, and Loki disguises her themself because they can change gender as well as the bridal maid. And of course, there's other ones. I think of the other ones where
I've talked about a number of weddings, by the way, because I'm also a celebrant, so I do funerals and I do weddings. And so when people ask for a wedding story, a lot of wedding stories in general sort of myth are awful, because it's usually someone dies horribly at the end of it, or they've been coerced into it, because that's the point of the story, rather than two people met, they fell in love and they got married and it was all perfectly normal and uninteresting. Whereas that story is great and it's great to tell, and there's lots of humor in there, and it's a lovely one to tell. And of course, the ridiculousness of Thrym the giant not seeing Thor, who's an enormous thunder god, and isn't just, what's his name, the terribly handsome Australian guy from Marvel with the hair in the beard. Supposed to be huge and dressed as, and it suddenly becomes a sort of slightly 1970s carry-on thing of this enormous thunder god. And of course, it's well known that as soon as you place a veil over a man's head, then he becomes completely indistinguishable, his gender. And Thrym just not getting it, to the point where he lifts up the veil and tries to kiss Thor, misses the enormous red bushy beard, red hair, and says, "Arise, arise, are all glowing like coals." and Loki, who again is he's swapped into this ambiguous gendered person who then becomes a young woman, a bridesmaid, who says, you know, well, she's been crying with excitement and that's why her eyes are raw. And Sims goes, perfectly plausible explanation, let's move on. But also, just to that point, there's a big, with the kind of the co-opting of Norse mythology by very right-wing groups. Again, like a lot of things that people with very fixed ideologies have cherry-picked things. And just because Thor and Odin are blokes most of the time, not all the time, but most of the time are blokes and are warriors and are big and tough. It's kind of like, right, so that's what men must mean. And Loki, what about Loki? Because sometimes he's a woman, sometimes he's a horse, sometimes he's a fly, sometimes he does this. And yet Freya, she's a goddess of love and magic and war and death. And yet, yeah, she sleeps with simultaneously a number of dwarves. And I have a colleague, a storytelling colleague called Amy Douglas, who does a lovely retelling of that. And it's all about, you know, from Freya's perspective, rather than isn't she a bit slutty and how awful she the necklace, it's, to quote her final words of the story, sometimes all a goddess needs is a good worshipping. You know, and it's a very sexy version of the story, which Freya is entirely upon her, you know, her terms, even though the dwarves are saying, you know, that we've got plenty of gold, we've got plenty of jewels, we don't want that, what we want is some time with you. It's a perfectly sort of consensual and mutually enjoyable experience for all of them. And if you take, because she's goddess of love, so she can do that sort of thing, she can do what she likes with that. It's not, she's not the goddess of monogamy.
I mean, Odin sleeps around a lot, so it's...
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how Frigg puts up with him, personally.
Well, it's like Zeus...
Unless she is the dutiful wife.
Yeah, oh God, absolutely, yeah. And it's... And he never sort of really... I mean, Zeus keeps getting... In Greek mythology, Zeus often gets told off, or his lovers or their children are often cursed or whatnot. But Odin seems to get away with it a bit more. What happens in Jotunheim stays in Jotunheim, kind of theory. But yeah, you're absolutely right. These are people jumping in and out of bed with each other, changing gender, changing species, doing all sorts of wonderful magical things. You can't pin them down with a narrow ideology to say it is this and this alone, and it is a fixed way. If you want to do that, then the only way to make it fixed is to say they are all changeable and do what they wish to do.
Yeah, I mean, they must, some part of ancient society must have reflected these parts to then be interposed on these gods and goddesses and characters. Yeah. There's a guy who's just set up his own Viking lore and legend podcast. He's mainly active on Threads, but I think he's active on other platforms. And his is more kind of a narrative telling of his interpretation, understanding of different elements of history. And thankfully, it's not too far to the right. It's not quite based on sagas, but it's always interesting to hear how people relate and understand different things.
Yeah.
And I know I was talking to him and he goes, well, what's your opinion on Freya? And I said, well, Freya is awesome. She's always overlooked. She takes half the dead. It's not all to Odin. Yes. She takes half the dead.
First choice.
He goes, oh my gosh, I did not know. So like, yes, people do not know Freya takes half the dead.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why I loved your story so much, especially kind of because it really honoured the fact that families might want to go to Folkvang. They might not want to go to Valhalla. I mean, where do the children go when they die? Do they get recruited and boosted up to Einherjar? I can never say that word. Einherjar. Nope. The worthy dead, basically. Yeah. You see how I struggle with Old Norse. I can't even say that word. Kind of thing. And of course, I really get that. I really get that.
But a lot of, as you kind of mentioned earlier about Snorri Sturluson, a lot of the Norse mythology has come down to us through a Christianization of stuff. And of course, without putting any sort of pejorative spin on it, the Abrahamic religions, that's, you know, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, are all from a patriarchal deity, an omnipotent patriarchal deity, and there are books of law for each different version of the religion that you may or may not subscribe to, and then of course all the other offsplits that people have created since then. So when somebody says, yes, this is Odin, you could kind of think of him a bit like God, if you want. And then you can think of so-and-so, and maybe they're a bit like somebody or other. You know, you get this syncretization. And of course, that happened in the pagan heathen world of Western Europe, where people came in and went, no, you've got to get rid of that. And they went, what, why? You've just got this one god, and he's dead, and his son arrived, and he's dead. Oh, but he rose from the dead. Oh, well, like Balder. Yes, if you like. Just like Balder,
yeah.
And then syncretizing saints with goddesses, you know, you've got Brit or Bridget in Ireland and Saint Bridget, and the combination of those are the Celtic gods and all those, because it works diplomatically when you're trying to convert an entire population from the culture that they have only ever known and see as their culture, to something entirely new. When you're sort of saying, yeah, we've got this offspin of a Jewish subcult from the Middle East, that doesn't sell quite as well as saying, well, no, it's about eternal life, and there's a thing here, and all, you know, your bits and your feast days are very similar, they're kind of the same, maybe this is just a refreshed version. And so, you know, all the and the Christianized, or the Christian copying down and recording, or the copying down recording of Christian by Christians of the Norse myths, even if they were trying to be as objective as possible, it would be very difficult for them not to add, when you have a number of different sources or a number of different versions, to pick one that you have a natural affinity towards. And I think you've kind of read some other versions of myths written down by other monks, who not Snorri, and some of them feel very Christianized. Which of course is what would have happened to them. It wouldn't have been what they originally would have been, but it was what gradually would and has happened to them, which is why you have people who now sort of co-opt things and kind of go, this fits my ideology because it's like that, without understanding the bigger world and the more elastic world and how people used and shaped and bent stories to their needs and to the cultures and to the people. And a lot of the time storytellers would have gone, what'll go down well in front of these people? Or what'll go down well in front of this nobleman or king or jarl or whatever? He'll pay me more if I say something brilliant about whatever. So I'll do that, and I'll keep my head, and I might get, you know. Mm-hmm. So these aren't true and accurate representations. They're filtered through human experience and culture, and just the individual storyteller going, oh, I've got a good idea. Let's do that here. Because that's what we...
Yeah, that's a very, very good point, of course. Sales performed to the royalty and the powers that be, not just the common folk. Of course, there's loads of praise poems. King Canute, bless him, had loads of good praise poems written by other people. And there was, of course, the famous poet Egil Skallagrimsson, who was the famous enemy of Eric Bloodaxe and his wife, Gunnhilda, the witch queen, kind of thing. And he wrote a poem that saved his head.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, you would. If you can either die, you can say something favourable. Well, my lord, let me tell you about a heroic thing that's just like you. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Of course, people do that. Yeah, again, there's a romanticisation. Was that it? Romanticisation?
That was it. You said it correctly, Rex.
It just popped out accidentally there. Yeah, there we go. I wasn't looking at it, and there it was. Of how storytellers, bards, skalds, you know, minstrels, all the kind of the storytelling, wandering storytellers, jobbing storytellers. And it's this idea of, you know, sitting around a campfire somewhere and telling people, you know, the truth, the ancient legends, or sitting, you know, at the end of a long table in an inn with people, you know, quietly sort of sitting there with their pints and their pipes. And of course, those are instances and how people do it. It's, you know, the equivalent of me turning up to a pub theatre today. The only difference is now, because it's a less heard of, less familiar type of art, then, you know, people come along and they buy their drinks and they all sit down quietly and look at me, because that's what you do in a theatre. And they all, you know, sit politely for a while, and then they clap in the middle bit, and then they come back after a wee and a drink, and they sit down and they watch again and they clap in the end bit, you know. And I'm sure some people just don't get it or don't like it. It's just not their thing, you know. And other people really love it, because it's, you know, it's that we all do. But that romanticization, and that doesn't feel right now. I think I said it right the first time. that somehow everyone would sit down, it'd be the same experience for everyone, and it would be the same stories told over and over again. No, you had good storytellers, bad storytellers, well-known stories, little-known stories, stories they made up on the spur of the moment, something that changed, something that in the room inspired them and meant they changed the story. Audiences who were half cut three sheets to the wind on their ale, some who were nice and juicy. All those different things come together to mean that the stories, and by that I also mean the myths and legends of people's religions and cultures, all the years, the stuff that we have written down now is just what the last person wrote down. And that person wrote down, and then everyone went said, well, because that's written down there, that must be the real one, and we'll go with that.
I know I've made a series of little shorts, as YouTube calls them, because Instagram calls them reels, so they can't call them that, so YouTube calls them shorts, showcasing a couple of my Viking-y books, including a couple of some nice illustrated editions of Norse myths, and I know one of the most popular ones is my Neil Gaiman's one with art by Levi Pinfold, and I had a comment just yesterday saying, hi, is this the same stories as Neil Gaiman's has, because I've read his, like, paperback hardback version of his retelling of Norse myths. Yeah. Yes, it is the same stories. I don't think all of them are there. And then the same person commented on another book, which I've got by Kevin Crossley Holland, which is his illustrated version. It's done with lino print. It's gorgeous. I must confess I've not read it yet. Oh. I've had it for a very long time. It's signed, but I've not read it yet. And they said, are these the same stories that Neil Gaiman sells of? And I'm like, yes and no.
Yeah.
Any book on Norse mythology is always a retelling. And I had to say, these stories are written 200 years after Christianization.
Yeah.
And the characters will be there, but their story arcs might be slightly different. They might have different features, different hair colours, kind of thing. I know I was speaking in the last episode to Katie Smith, an illustrator from York Archaeology, and she made the one and only Jorvik Top Trump card set, which I recommend everyone gets. And she's depicted Loki as blonde, which I actually find really refreshing, because so often he's depicted as a redhead, just to stand out differently from a usually blonde Thor or a brown Thor, or sometimes he's red, but I've always seen Loki as red. I've never seen him blonde anywhere else. And I told her that was really nice to see.
Yeah.
So it is just really interesting to see how some people do, as you say, think, come across one book and think that's it. That's all I need to read. So surely this other book is exactly the same. They're not, but it's that beautiful difference, that variation that helps these stories keep living so well. And of course, through your beautiful skill of a storyteller, they go even further.
Yeah, it's very much that. And I think it's the idea of things like when we have things like the Bible, we have a thing there that I'm sure not a lot of people, or rather, I'm saddened to see more and more people sort of think that these were the words that Jesus and the apostles wrote down, as opposed, again, to sort of saying, no, these were written down hundreds of years after the event, and not by the people who originally said them or spoke them, but by people who had been told, ear to mouth and ear to mouth and ear to mouth and ear to mouth over those hundreds of years, and then they were written down, and then they were edited by the Romans. But because it's in a book and people refer to things like the Bible or the Torah or the Quran or whatever, people say, well, that must be the word, the literal word of people. Whereas I think it is unhealthy to think about that, because then it becomes law and reality. And the same with the Norse thing, because Snorri Sturluson wrote down a thing and all, we've got one record of it. It's kind of, this is what happened. But I think that's just people's lack of experience and understanding with that there are many different sources for cultural items. What we do is, and what we do as entertainers or authors or writers or whatever, is to say, well, I'm going to write one down and I'm going to do this. I have my own version of the Viking story, illustrated Viking stories as well, which is my retelling of those. And I wouldn't say it was the right one, but it's the copy and the transcription of how I tell the stories and how I, as a storyteller, am comfortable telling those stories and how they have been received. And I have changed the telling of those stories over time. And the ones I wrote down will have changed from the first time I told those stories, which would have been researched from a whole number of inputs. But yet again, you can kind of think, well, that's the answer. Yeah. But it's not. We cover all these different kind of things, and it's healthy, I think, to understand that we have these this cross-pollination and numerous sources for things, because then we should be able to look and understand and analyze that information and those stories ourselves to come across our own understanding of meaning.
Yeah, it's not always evident, as you say. It's almost deliberately hidden that these stories aren't taken straight from the word of the person who first invented the story. For example, with part of my Valkyrie research, I was looking at different stories of Valkyries, especially the build-up to the Saga of the Volsungs, which is my main focus.
Yeah.
And there is an early tale of the Prince Helgi Hundingsbane, his second poem, because he's got three about him, but I was looking at the second one. And in the second one, he finds a Valkyrie, she gets his victory in battle, but she's betrothed to someone else. So he goes kill that someone else, but then one of his friends betrays him and he dies. And then she dies from grief because she's like, oh, well, I've got no purpose to be here now, as you do.
Yeah, yeah.
But in the Eddic poem itself, in the translation that I've got, I think it's in the Poetic Edda, that's it, but I've got the Poetic Edda by Caroline Larrington. And it says, in the words of the scribe, in a later story, as told in pagan times, which is the biggest red flag you could find, like, this is like yeah. the original person.
You know, pagan times.
These two characters were reincarnated. He was known as Halfdan something, and she was known as Favas.
Yeah.
So Kara, Halfdan's daughter, and she too was a Valkyrie. I'm like, where is that? And it was also, that was it. So they say it's known as the Song of Kara. And I'm like, where is the Song of Kara today? Yeah. That is missing. That is lost. That has not been chosen to put in. It's got a little footnote.
Yeah.
That's all we have. And it's sad to see that there were more stories about these female characters, Valkyries, mythical or semi-shield maiden in role.
Yes.
And that we've just lost them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yes, it's interesting, the number of, when you talk about, there seems to be a bit of a sort of a crossover between Valkyries and shield maidens and things. Yeah, in the Volsungs, and when Sigurd comes across Brynhild, and you know, she says, you know, I'm a Valkyrie, you know, and Odin cursed me and popped me with a sleep thorn because I didn't, you know, I beat the side that he wanted to win in battle. But yet she has a lineage and she has a parentage, you know, a mortal parentage, which she refers to. There's a brother. Isn't that brother something like Attila the Hun or something?
I think so, yes. That is, it's a strange kind of like mishmash of history mixing with the mythological parts.
I think also in that, because it comes out of Scandinavia, we always think, oh, Vikings and sagas, well, that's got to be Norway, could be Sweden, and then, yeah, maybe Iceland at a kind of a third. Not Finland, that's completely different. Or could be Denmark. But you suddenly realise that they're in... what's it called? Francia, which of course is Germany.
Germany.
And you say, oh, they've come down the Rhine. So actually it's happening down there, not up in, you know, the wilds of Norway, not even in Denmark. It is a hodgepodge of all sorts of things that you come across. But yeah, so that these sort of supernatural characters have ill-defined boundaries. And you can talk about the Valkyries who ride down from the skies and collect the souls of the glorious dead, the angelic side of them. Oh, that's a nice thing as well. We can blend that with other religions. They're like angels. That's it. Just think angels.
Yep. Don't get me started on where people are giving them wings from in imagery. I don't know where people are doing that from yet. I haven't quite pinned it down.
No, I suppose, you know, it'll be, again, a romanticization. Mm-hmm. Of something probably from a Victorian inspired things, winged helmets and whatnot, which comes from the idea of angels having wings, whereas only a few types of angels have wings. Some of them are absolutely bonkers, swirling balls of light with 1,000 eyes. But we see fewer of those in the stained glass windows because they're not as pretty as the things that look like us. But yes, there's ill-defined boundaries. So yes, so sometimes they are these angels. Sometimes they are the cup bearers of Odin who wait on his table. He would have, if he were an important person, like any important person in the early medieval period and before, if you're important, you have servants and you have people who wait on you. So part of that is just that's the culture of the day. And yes, you may well have had women wait on you, but warrior women as well. That would be even cooler if you are a warrior, you know, and a heroic culture. And you have these other things between basically someone who's a waiter, someone who's a psychopomp escorting the souls of the dead off to shield maidens, and they're somewhere between kind of strange spirit woman warrior and just a woman who's a warrior who happens to be a woman, perhaps is unusual and therefore defined as a shield maiden. I don't know where I was going with that, but yes, lots of ill-defined
values. No, it's fine. It's all really, really good. I mean, I could quite happily talk to you for ages, but I am aware of the time because I am doing this during my working day, and I know you've probably got your own plans. So we do sadly have to try and wrap this episode up to a close.
Sure.
But gosh, I could talk to you about all these things for absolutely hours because I've got that many ideas and views, and it's lovely to find someone who connects on the same level as well, which is why I do this podcasting, because I don't have anyone in my modern life that does. Understand my connection. I mean, one of my mum friends, and I've said this before in previous episodes, I won't name her because I know she didn't listen, but I'm embarrassed. She's like, who is Thor and how do we know about him? And like, those are two very good but very big questions.
Yeah, absolutely.
How do we know about Thor? I said, I don't know how to begin with that one, darling, because you don't know Marvel. So that's often a starting point for most people.
You should meet her on a Thursday and ask her about that and say, how do you know about, because it's Thor's day today. I wrote that in Genius Queens.
You meet on Thursday.
Yeah.
I will try that with her when I see her later this week.
Yeah.
Oh, but thank you so much. But before we go, please do let our viewers and listeners know where they can hear your stories or see you perform in person.
Yes, indeed. So I'm based in the UK, based in the West Midlands of England, but I do perform all over the UK. I also perform online as well quite a lot. So if you can sit in your pyjamas with a cup of coffee or a can of beer, and you can either watch live online or you can watch later. All my online shows are recorded, and then the story bit is available later if you can't make the thing. But the best way, the easiest places to find me are either on Facebook or on my website or Instagram or even Blue Sky. And if you just search for Jason Buck Storyteller, don't just search for Jason Buck. You'll get a Texan politician and an American football player and all sorts of other things. But yeah, Jason Buck Storyteller. You can find me there. And I regularly perform live, in person, and also online. So you can find me in those places.
Brilliant. Well, I will also put the links down below to the 2 episode recording you did of your Shield Maiden story, because I went and rewatched that in the build up to this recording, and I still loved it.
Good.
Even though it was a couple of years ago, which is, it just shows how stories still retain such power, no matter how long ago they were told. I was also like, final question, do you think you'll be back at Jorvik in 2026?
I believe I will. I've sort of snuck into the edge of Jorvik back in 2020, when I snuck into the edge last minute into the Jorvik fringe, and as I did this time, I think it was only because I did a bit more of my own publicity and gave them links to events and things, and they thought, oh, okay, this bloke seems to be all right in sort of self promotion, so we'll put him in on the thing as well. So I just kind of snuck in the back door. But I think after I did some of the street storytelling and did the show, and the show sold out, lovely. Often that show does, the Dark Norse, they sort of said, oh yeah, give us a shout next year. So in what form I'll be back, I don't know, but I would like to think that absolutely, yes, I will be back at Jorvik in 2026.
Brilliant. Well, I hope to see you again in person in 2026, if not attend one of your online storytelling sessions, maybe one day, all being well with getting the kid to bed and that whole circus.
Thank you very much for inviting me on. Yeah, been great chats. The time has zoomed past.
It has. It's a shame I can't make these episodes too long, or people may well need to not fit it into their own day.
Right.
It's been a real pleasure, Jason. Thank you so much for being a willing and happy guest. It's been a wonderful conversation. And for viewers and listeners, stay tuned. Do hit subscribe wherever you're listening and viewing. There'll be the usual Valhalla Conversations episodes coming up. I've got a guest planned for every month, right up until October. Even November, it's only December, I need to fill in. But I am still trying to see if I can recruit any more Jorvik Met Festival members, events, persons to make this mini series a bit longer, but that's why I've always used the word mini because everyone's busy and everyone's doing things. But thank you very much for listening and being wherever you are. And thank you very much, Jason.
My pleasure. Thanks all. Bye-bye.